This afternoon, I thought of continuing the reflection on conditionality. Primarily from the perspective of the teaching of dependent co-arising, Paticca Samuppada. Dependent origination, sometimes it's called. I'm not planning to do a detailed dive into all of the links like I sometimes do, but just kind of give a broad brush sense of dependent origination, and then dive into a couple of the links more particularly, ones that kind of feel more along the lines of a conversation that feels like it's in process. The Buddha taught Paticca Samuppada, the dependent co-arising, origination, as a general principle, stated in a very broad brush form. When this is, that is. When this arises, that arises. And to me, this expresses kind of two different aspects of conditionality. When this is, that is kind of the expression of things arising together. When this arises, that arises, to me, can be more the conditions shaping the future, more in the sense of conditions leading in a direction. And then the other half of the general principle of conditionality is when this isn't, that isn't. When this ceases, that ceases. So it expresses both how things come to be and how things fall apart. There are some different instantiations or particular elaborations of this general principle in the suttas. One set of those elaborations, and there are a couple of different, maybe as many as three, different forms of the principle of dependent origination that describes the arising of suffering. Describing the arising of suffering and the sense of selfing, the selfing that is believed to be an abiding entity. So dependent origination in one form expresses that, how suffering comes to be. It's a very detailed description in one form. It's 12 links that describe how suffering comes to be. And that's the more familiar to most of us, a more familiar formulation. There's another one that uses 10 links. But it's a kind of a description of what goes on in our system, in our human system. It answers the question, essentially, that so many people have. It's like, why? Why does this happen? You know, why does this go on? And the Buddha describes just this kind of unfolding chain, the tumbling on, that when not seen, it just tends to keep tumbling on in that direction, conditioning more suffering, conditioning more sense of selfing. There's another description of the general formulation that has a completely different direction. It points to or describes the conditions that support the movement to freedom. And so this is a lovely reflection. I think knowing, holding these two together, that there are conditions that support the arising of suffering, and that's kind of common. It's more than kind of. It's the habit of the human mind to follow that pattern. But it is conditioned. It's not the fact that it's described as a conditioned unfolding means that if the conditions are shifted or dismantled, then the suffering falls apart. I think of the description of the specific instantiation, the specific describing of dependent origination connected with the arising of suffering to be propelled by, it's propelled by ignorance, it's propelled by craving. Essentially, it's propelled by greed, aversion, and delusion. So that's kind of the cycle of dependent origination is conditioned by greed, aversion, and delusion, and then in turn conditions more greed, aversion, and delusion, which is kind of why it's hard to break out of. Like I was saying this morning around the job description, like of aversion. When aversion arises in the mind, it tends to condition the mind to look for things to be averse to, which conditions more aversion. So it's hard to break out of these cycles without some understanding of how the cycle is being propelled onward by greed, aversion, and delusion, and the ignorance underlying greed, aversion, and delusion that propels this whole cycle. But the kind of flip side of having another set of conditions that lead to freedom . Both of these chains include suffering. The one chain describes how suffering comes to be, and then kind of inferentially that suffering tends to, because it's based in the belief, like for instance with aversion, the belief that aversion, getting rid of this thing, that separation from something is what's going to make me happy, that belief then propels more aversion, and so tends to, when the suffering arises in connection with aversion, it tends to, the mind tends to be confused about how happiness comes to be, and it just keeps going in that cycle. And so suffering can tend to reproduce more suffering. But the other chain of transcendent dependent origination, sometimes it's called, the sutta that in which that teaching is described, the name of that sutta is something like supportive conditions, the Upanisa Sutta. Supportive conditions for freedom. And it kind of begins with suffering. Suffering may lead in the direction of ignorance, bewilderment, confusion, repeating the patterns. And it can also lead, if there is a teaching that points out of that cycle, that says, hey, there is a way to kind of break that cycle, then that suffering joined with hearing that teaching can lead to faith. which in the other day, talking about the five faculties, faith being one of the five faculties, when there is faith arising, it can lead to engagement. Practice, exploring a whole different approach. And so these two chains kind of overlap at suffering. Suffering is both a supportive condition for more suffering, and suffering is a supportive condition for freedom when it is met with wisdom. So that's a delightful reflection for me. You know, this unfolding, tumbling on of conditions isn't destined to continue recreating suffering when we bring the understanding of suffering is essentially the key, the linchpin. When we can understand suffering, that first noble truth, understand suffering, understand how suffering arises. So today I mostly want to kind of look at the description of how suffering is created, again, in a kind of a broad brush fashion. It's a pretty clear unpacking. As I said this morning, you know, the Buddha was amazing at describing the workings of the human mind and the teaching of dependent origination in terms of its description of how suffering comes to be is one of the examples of the complexity of how the human mind works. But it's a clear description that suffering comes to be in dependence on conditions. So suffering is conditioned. It is not, in the Buddha's teaching of this, it's not a foregone conclusion. Now here we do have to distinguish the difference between suffering and what the Buddha meant by the kind of suffering we can be free of. He did not mean that we will be free from unpleasant sensation. So that's not the freedom from suffering. But rather, in many places, the Buddha kind of describes, or it seems to me that one of the clearest, most succinct definitions of freedom, the freedom from suffering the Buddha pointed to, he said, the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion, this is Nibbana. This is freedom. This is release. This is cooling. The fire, cooling the fire. And so the suffering that can end is the suffering of greed, aversion, and delusion. Greed, aversion, and delusion can cease. So this chain, suffering can be created, and it describes, this chain describes essentially starting from, I'll just name them first and then I'll go through them a little bit. So starting with ignorance, ignorance of suffering basically is the head of the chain. With ignorance as condition, mental formations come to be. Mental formations in dependence on ignorance. So certain kinds of mental formations come to be in dependence on ignorance. In dependence on ignorance, mental formations come to be. With mental formations as a condition, consciousness. With consciousness as condition, mental and physical processes come to be. the six sense bases follow or arise with contact, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, aging, and death. As the Buddha often says at that point, when he says aging and death, he says, and there you have the entire mass of suffering. So the way this is often explored in a pedagogical fashion, in terms of a teaching methodology, is that entire mass of suffering tends to loop back to create ignorance. I mentioned this earlier, that there's a statement the Buddha made, you know, suffering leads to either bewilderment, confusion, ignorance, or search. And if that search is met with a teaching that describes a different way, that can lead to faith. So there's that branching point. So often this cycle describes from ignorance all the way around through suffering, but often what happens there with all of that suffering is that the ignorance is reinforced. So it tends to be experienced as a cycle. It's a complex teaching. There's lots to it. And I often find it easiest to kind of enter into this description or this discussion by starting not with ignorance. I mean, I've talked a little bit about ignorance now, but those first few links, ignorance, conditions, mental formations, conditions, consciousness, conditions, mind and mental and physical processes, to me, those were so hard to get through. It was like a slog when I was first hearing about this. And by the time I got to the things that seemed more clear, I was exhausted. So I like to start where it's a little easier to kind of get some traction with what the teachings are saying. So, you know, we've got a mind and a body. You know, we've got these six sense bases. We've got mental and physical processes. We kind of know that. We've got this body kind of sitting here. And this body tends to be impinged on by sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, things going on in the mind. So that's contact. That's the next link we have. Because we have this mind and body and these six sense bases, we see, we hear, we smell, we taste, we touch. Things go on in the mind. And so this is the description of this as contact. We're contacted by experience. There's contact with the sense doors. And each of those contacts, co-arising with each of those contacts. I think of that as when this is, that is kind of arising. Arising with each of those contacts is also a feeling tone. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neither pleasant or unpleasant. Now, I think that partly, there's other things that arise at the same time as that contact. Perception, for instance, arises with that contact. But here the Buddha is highlighting the conditions leading to suffering in a particular way. There are other places where the Buddha talks about chains that are kind of chaining off of perception. But here he's really kind of emphasizing, in some ways, this feeling piece and how suffering is created because we don't understand feeling. And because the habits of greed, aversion, and delusion tend to respond to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So with every sense contact, there is a feeling tone. And based on that feeling tone, the mind tends to, because it's, you know, infused with the habitual perspective of get what I want, get rid of what I don't want, it shifts from, you know, that that kind of bare sense of, oh, this is a pleasant thing, to wanting to hold on to pleasant, to wanting to get rid of unpleasant. Maybe not really noticing the neutral experience. So there's that movement, that shift, or that kind of arising. This to me is like when this arises, that tends to arise. This is that form of dependent origination. When feeling arises, craving tends to arise. And in this case, the craving will arise when there's ignorance in the mind, when there is the perspective of, already the perspective of, if I get this thing that's pleasant, I'll be happy. And so that's, in a way, how this whole chain is shaped by the ignorance. So, and we could say, too, that, you know, that feeling and craving will be more co-arising when ignorance is present in the mind. When feeling is arising in the condition of mind of ignorance, where there's not mindfulness, there's the views and beliefs around greed and aversion that are motivating the mind, feeling will lead to craving, because the mind doesn't have another perspective it can work from. So feeling tends to lead to craving. We like what we want. You know, we want to get what's pleasant, get rid of what's unpleasant. And this is also a very, you know, it's based in evolutionary biology as well. You know, this tendency to go for, you know, what's pleasant, to get rid of what's unpleasant. Even, you know, single-celled creatures tend to move towards nourishment and away from noxious chemicals. So it's very deeply ingrained there. Some of the conditioning comes, some of the conditioning around that movement from feeling to craving comes from our own learning, our own kind of what we've experienced in the past, and the getting the sense that, oh, if I get a thing I want, I get that little hit of like, it's okay, it feels pretty good. So we learn ourselves that, and we don't have an example of a different way, a different kind of happiness, of recognizing that the release from greed and aversion is actually a different kind of happiness. And so we end up, you know, just kind of having that co-arising, or that very conditioned arising, when ignorance is present in the mind. It's like the chain of suffering gets picked up. When feeling arises, craving arises. So that craving, you know, that's a very habitual response based on that feeling tone. Craving arises. Craving to get rid of. With craving arises the desire to have or get rid of, the actual doing of the having or the getting rid of. That's the clinging. So this, I think of craving and clinging as kind of being gradations. It's like the craving is the movement towards, that looks good, and the clinging is, got it. Following on from craving and clinging, some teachers, Bhikkhu, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, says that the kind of the intentions that are formed in the service of that clinging, it's like the need to keep this, the identity that forms around the one who has this thing, the sense of control that one has, all of that, the intentions and actions that arise in dependence or in service of that craving and clinging. That's what we could call becoming. So again, it's the kind of the movement towards, okay, I've got this thing, I need to control it. It's that kind of flavor. I need to make sure I keep this. I need to make sure I keep this at bay. I need to make sure everybody knows I've got this. That's that kind of terrain of becoming. And then, again, kind of in a shading manner, like I just talked about from craving to clinging, that's, I kind of also think of becoming to birth. And in this case, I'm looking at or exploring this chain of dependent origination, not in terms of birth into a new life, but just birth into an identity, really kind of solidifying, this is me, this is who I am, kind of a reification or an intensification of that becoming. Like clinging is an intensification of craving, birth is an intensification of becoming. A clear sense of I am the one who has this control. It's like the becoming is the, oh yeah, I'm going to be the person everybody admires and respects. And the birth is, I am the person everybody admires and respects. It's that kind of sense. And the Buddha says it from this place, or actually, I think from craving, you know, right from craving, right from the get-go. Craving is already suffering. You know, this whole thing that says then, you know, the entire mass of suffering with aging and death. It's like, in my experience, when craving arises, suffering is already arising. It's not like we have to wait to experience suffering until there's becoming and birth and aging and death. Although some of that birth, you know, that sense of I am the one who has that respect, that sense of identity masks the suffering of the craving. It's got this, like, it's a world our mind has constructed, and the mind has taken up residence in that almost like fantasy-like place, and it's kind of happy with that. But that construction, it's, you know, it's a bubble in the mind. It's actually pretty ready to be burst as soon as there's some kind of evidence to the contrary. Or something happens where we don't have control of that thing we thought we had control of. At one point on a retreat, I kept kind of flipping between this sense of, I'm a good yogi, I can do this, and I can't even be mindful. I'm a terrible yogi. I am a failure. And just like these flipping between these identities. Because, you know, it's like sometimes the practice was unfolding in a way that there was clarity and understanding, and sometimes the practice was unfolding in the way that there was confusion. Like, no self needs to be involved there, but there was an identification that came along with both of those and suffering around that. I am a good yogi. It's like I could only be happy as long as that was still perceived to be the case. And evidence came along regularly to show that I couldn't control that. That I couldn't control whether I was always experiencing things in the practice the way I thought a good yogi would. And so that sense of identification, that sense of I am, and that whole complex of fantasy there, it will burst at some point. And that's the death, that's the aging and death of that identity. And suffering results there. And then coming back to the beginning of the chain, so as I said a few moments ago, the suffering there, like, oh, I'm a failure. I'm not the good yogi. I'm not the person everybody admires and respects. I'm not the person I admire and respect. That's one of the ones I had. When all we understand is the motivations based in greed, aversion, and delusion, when that's the conditioning, right? We think, okay, you know, I'm a failure, so what do I need to do? I need to work harder to prove that I can be that good yogi. And so that greed and that sense of aversion to the failure and all of that. It's like believing that reality of that need to have that identity leads into another kind of the ignorance that, first of all, that ignorance of that identity even has an existence, and that it's important to keep that identity going, the not understanding suffering as a part of that ignorance. So that ignorance is really motivated by those beliefs I talked about this morning in the job description of aversion, you know, the belief around that's motivating aversion is that if I get rid of this thing, I'll be happy. The belief motivating greed is if I get this thing, I'll be happy. So these are kind of, this is the ignorance embedded in greed and aversion. And then the more fundamental ignorance. Aversion says, this is what will make me happy. I mean, greed says, this is what will make me happy. Aversion, getting rid of this will make me happy. Delusion says, there is a me to make happy. That's kind of the foundational ignorance. And not understanding suffering. Not understanding that this propelling of acting on those beliefs is what is productive of suffering. So this ignorance, as I mentioned a few moments ago, it's like this ignorance is the launching pad for the entire chain towards suffering. You know, when ignorance is arising, when that belief already, when we're starting from the perspective, I need to get something pleasant in order to be happy, when that's what's motivating the mind, then pleasant feeling is going to lead to craving. Unpleasant feeling is going to lead to aversion. So when the ignorance is motivating the mind, it's like already those conditions are the stage is set for the craving, the clinging, the becoming to happen with that ignorance in the mind. So the next part of the chain, when with ignorance as condition, mental formations come to be. Now this is again these are the mental formations that arise in dependence on ignorance, in dependence on that underlying belief. So with the underlying belief, getting what I want will lead to happiness, that tends to condition greed, the mental formation of greed. And so greed arising in the mind, aversion arising in the mind. And we tend to have habitual, kind of go-to belief strategies for happiness. My own tends to be, if I get rid of things that are unpleasant, then I'll be happy. You know, so leading this mind to walk into a room and kind of search out all the unpleasant things, trying to figure out how to get rid of them so that I can finally relax. That strategy, that ignorance, or that kind of condition of the ignorance around aversion, leading to, you know, the strategy of aversion in the mind. Thinking it's going in the direction of happiness, but actually it's moving in the direction of suffering. And so these mental formations conditioned by ignorance, there's a lot of different ways that these come into being. And, you know, the foundational ones I've just mentioned around greed, aversion, and delusion, many of those are kind of based in our, you know, humanness. I think it's very rare for a human being to be born that does not have this tendency to want to get pleasant things, to want to get rid of unpleasant things. I don't know if such a being would be born. It seems very deeply rooted in being human that this pattern is there. So some of these patterns, these habits, of mental formations rooted in ignorance seem to come with being human and come with a misunderstanding about kind of misperceptions about experience, taking things to be permanent, taking things to be reliable. So some of, and as I said, I think I said earlier, you know, that those strategies or those kind of human conditions, those human proclivities are reinforced by our own experience. And we find out as we, you know, from the time we're really young, you know, if I cry and mom comes and makes me feel better, you know, if I'm uncomfortable and I cry, mom comes and makes me feel better. And it's like this reinforcement of, you know, acting on the strategy, and it keeps us alive. You know, it's not. I'm not suggesting that we, you know, try to train babies not to cry so moms don't come. I mean, that's not what I'm saying here. But I'm just saying that how habitual it is, and that we learn in our lives that this strategy is at least effective to give us a little bit of happiness, a little bit of sense of, oh, okay, got it. And, you know, that's about all that we ever learn about happiness for most of us. When I get something I want, I feel good. I feel happy. When I get rid of something that I don't want, I feel better. I've got a sense of control. And so that reinforces, you know, it reinforces our own experience of this is how the way to go to happiness. And then there's a lot of other conditions in our own lives, you know, how we've been responded to and what our physical body, can handle or not handle, kind of, you know, certain bodies can tolerate certain foods and not other foods. And so there's all kinds of conditions that come that shape us and our responses to the world. I remember at one point, you know, how I got really annoyed at somebody. This was like I was in my early 20s or something, and I went over to somebody's house, and you know, they served lettuce and this salad, and I tended to like one kind of lettuce, and they had used another kind of lettuce, and I heard this thought in my mind: don't they know I like this kind of lettuce? I was like, no, of course not. You know, but this kind of belief that the world should be, you know, organized around my own happiness. So some of those, you know, kind of preferences and views, you know, are shaped by our own personal experience. And then some of them are also shaped by, you know, how our families are and what culture we grew up in. Now, culture, in a way, could be seen as shared beliefs, shared mental formations, shared views. These kind of mental formations, you know, you know, it's like that they often are harder to see because what you're growing up with, people around you are reinforcing those beliefs, those views. And so those things just become true or normal. This is the way it is. So, for example, mental formations around the idea of race, you know, views, beliefs, ideas connected to that idea. Many of us grow up, or maybe even all of us grow up with some perspectives around race. Some skillful, some not so skillful. And often those, you know, shared beliefs, shared perspectives are harder to see, harder to recognize as mental formations. You know, it's just taken to be, this is the nature of the way the world is. It's taken to be some kind of global or like more wide-ranging truth. And a lot of suffering comes from those kind of, we could call them collective mental formations, but we each, you know, kind of have internalized these collective mental formations, these views, these beliefs from our cultures, from our families. And so this is a place that I wanted to linger, because yesterday I was kind of reflecting on the internal and the external, and this is a place where the internal and the external meet. The external conditions of our culture, of our family, shaping our views, shaping our beliefs. We're not born with these views and beliefs. They are taught to us, often not so much by words saying, this is what you'll believe, but just through how people behave. The actions, the intentions are absorbed. And I think that's another reason why they're harder to see. Because they're not so much articulated as propositions in the mind. They've been absorbed through kind of actions, intentions. And so, you know, the mental formations that we have received, if we think about from the time where we were children, we received a lot of views, beliefs, ideas, opinions that have kind of informed. And some of these include, you know, the whole reinforcement around get what you want, you'll be happy, get rid of what you want, you know, you'll be happy. You know, those are also reinforced with our cultural perspectives, sometimes in particular ways. Get these things, you'll be happy. In this particular culture, or many of the threads of the culture in this country, the work really hard, you'll be happy is a kind of a condition. You know, that other places, there's maybe different things that are valued. So we absorb all of these from the time that we're very young. And then we just, you know, they become part of that cycle of dependent origination. They become part of us. They become part of how we act. They shape our intentions. They shape our cravings. They shape our clinging, our becoming, what we value, the wanting to be the someone who's admired and respected, all coming from these kind of collective mental formations. And so we've been informed by the external. I think I'm thinking of this right now in this like figure eight kind of thing. The mental formations of others, one chain of dependent origination right here, the mental formations of others being transmitted to us. Us picking up those mental formations and our chain following on. And our own mental formations have an effect, not only in our own mind, but also affect others. We've been affected by others, their views, their opinions, their ideas. And in the conditions of the world where mindfulness and wisdom are not widely available, we tend to just pick them up without discernment. And act on them and contribute back to that broader condition in the world of these mental formations swimming, that we're all swimming in. Buddha used the phrase, I'll have to see if I can find the place this is in the suttas, that this practice or this middle way is like swimming against the stream. And this is my image, that these this currents of the stream of mental formations that we're all swimming in, it's really hard to see this current, this direction, that there's another way, because everything, all of the mental formations that we're exposed to, or most of the mental formations we're exposed to until we come into the Dharma, is this direction of mental formations based in greed, aversion, and delusion. And so we have this cycle that not only are we receiving our mental formations from the kind of collective pool of mental formations, but we're contributing those mental formations. We're contributing because our mental formations lead to actions. This is another kind of place of the teaching in the five aggregates. Mental formations is one of the five aggregates. It describes, in one teaching, it describes the five aggregates as processes. The process of the body is the process of the body that is contacted, basically. And then feeling, it says, why is it called feeling? Because it feels. Feeling feels. Perceiving perceives. Consciousness knows. Mental formations, he says, mental formations form. What do they form? They form the experience of the body and feeling and perception and knowing and mental formations. This is the definition of the process of mental formations. That is the constructor of experience. It is described as being that which constructs the aggregates, the other aggregates. So mental formation constructs form, constructs feeling, constructs perception in line with its intentions. So when anger arises, it shapes the body, it contorts the face, heat perhaps arises in the system. The body changes with the arising of anger. It shapes the feeling. Things tend to become unpleasant. We tend to look for unpleasant. It shapes perception, perhaps seeing things as a threat. It shapes the knowing. It shapes that we tend to orient to things to be angry about, perhaps one version of that. And it tends to construct more anger. So all of the arising of mental formation internally conditions our aggregates, conditions us towards acting out of that experience, acting out of that anger in this case. And so that then contributes into the pool. When others are present, they are experiencing that contortion of our face, that those verbal darts that are being sent. I mean, we all know that experience of when somebody is angry and we're there in the room with them, it tends to, you know, make us feel angry or defensive or, lash out sometimes. So external anger tends to create internal anger. And so for us too, when we have anger, it, can tend to create the conditions for it to arise in others, not only arise internally, but externally. Not necessarily, if there is mindfulness available, not necessarily, but often habitually, anger internally creates conditions for anger to arise in others. So we are, you know, in this intertwined loop of dependent origination. So our mental formations tend to affect what we become aware of. And when we have an intention in a particular direction, and this is a kind of a neutral function of mind, in a way, that when the mind is oriented around a particular intention, this is called selective attention in our psychological descriptions these days, selective attention, when there's a kind of an intention in the mind of focus, our mind tends to screen in things that are relevant to that intention and screen out things that are not relevant to that intention. This can be very useful if we're trying to do something very focused. Kind of helps to kind of weed out what's not relevant to the task related to that intention. So that can be a kind of a neutral process in our minds, but often that neutral process is co-opted by unwholesome mental formations. So when the intention of anger, aversion, greed is arising in the mind tends to orient towards taking in from the environment things that are relevant around that mental formation. So if we're angry, we tend to take in things that are relevant to that anger, proof of why we should be angry, not seeing, correspondingly, things that are maybe not that are counter to that perspective. This kind of happens a lot, that we take in information that confirms our biases. We do not see things that don't confirm our biases. So knowing that, you know, having that information can be really useful, so that when we see our mind heading in that direction, you know, heading towards being shaped by a particular intention, when mindfulness comes, we might be curious, well, you know, what other information is here? I brought that in the other day. What else is here? What am I missing? And then, so that consciousness, what we are conscious of, and so what we become aware of is already filtered based on ignorance, based on our mental formations. And so coming back to this place of the dependent origination where we're looking at the mind and body, receiving sense impressions, we are not this kind of blank slate receiving all sense impressions. We are already filtering things based on our proclivities. That first time through, looking at, oh, we've got this mind and body, and there's sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch. Well, those sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch and the things arising in our mind have been shaped already by this whole stream of mental formations, conditioning, the ignorance, and our own our own conditions have radically shaped what gets through. So fortunately, It is possible to change the conditions of this cycle with mindfulness and wisdom. Often the feeling craving link is described as a place to kind of, you know, burst that cycle. Noticing, it's just pleasant feeling, you know, when we can really be at that place, just knowing this is pleasant sensation, it kind of begins to, you know, it may undermine that kind of the belief or the automatic movement to craving. When feeling tone is met with some wisdom, it can kind of change the direction. It doesn't necessarily have to go towards craving. So I was thinking about this earlier today. I thought, well, that kind of teaching around the feeling-craving link, and, you know, we can break the cycle of dependent origination at feeling, that feels like a very personal perspective around dependent origination that will break the cycle in this being internally, or can break that cycle. There's another exploration around becoming awake to the chains, the components of this chain. There's one particular teaching in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's Majjhima 9, for those of you who are interested in this, that describes each and every link of dependent origination and points to bringing wise attention to each and every link. When we understand mental formations arising, mental formations, that it is a mental formation, that it's arising, that it can cease, there can be freedom right there. And that's true of craving, of clinging, of becoming, wherever we are, whatever we are waking up to, wherever we end up waking up in that chain, or whatever is obvious for us in that, the sense of self, the experience of craving and suffering, whatever's obvious there, when mindfulness and wisdom can meet that, ignorance can be kind of released, and freedom can happen right there. And so I was reflecting on the, you know, the mental formation link, and how an exploration of understanding mental formation, understanding mental formation as arising, understanding mental formation as ceasing, and thinking about it internally and externally too. You know, this top, the conversation we were having yesterday, the knowing, oh, there's mental formation arising externally. There's anger arising externally. There's frustration arising internally. There's greed arising internally. There's confusion arising externally. When we can see that, and as the commentaries pointed to, either the internal or the external deep seeing of things as arising and ceasing in this way can lead to realization. I was reflecting that, you know, this exploration around mental formations in particular might be a way to contribute to a different, like, composition of that stream of mental formations. It's not hopeless by any means, but it does take the courage. I think it takes a lot of courage to watch these processes unfolding, both internally and externally, and not respond habitually, but respond instead from this perspective of mindfulness and wisdom that brings in the relational Brahmaviharas brings in love and compassion. And we see internally the way this chain unfolds and understand, some of you mentioned this in some of the meetings, right? This is not just about me. There's a way that the seeing of it internally can help us to appreciate, kind of like at one point I saw, or you know, saw how my own mind was heading in the direction of like anger to a particular person, and how like I wanted them to be miserable, I wanted them to suffer. And in that moment, seeing that clearly and feeling the kind of chain that was propelling me in that direction, there was also the understanding, like the extrapolation, this is happening 6 billion times over in the world. No wonder it's such a mess. And it led to a sense of compassion. And so this exploration brings in wisdom, but also brings in those relational qualities of love, compassion, and joy. And the Buddha said it is possible. It is possible to free the mind from greed, aversion, and delusion. He said to his followers, if it were not possible, I wouldn't ask you to do it. Let's just sit for a moment.